Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. What I'm about to read is something I've written, so therefore I should give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the cosmos, and I call it, What If Disaster Strikes? Today, on the eve of the 14th anniversary of 9/11, we speak of disaster, a word from the old Greek that means against the stars, because such local portents as comets and even meteors seen against the stars have for millennia been observed as indicators of impending disaster of some sort or another for nervous sky watchers. As most of you are undoubtedly aware, this week is the fall pledge drive for KMUN, and it is concerned with responding to disasters and how this public radio station is a necessary component of keeping everyone aware. Our prime example is the 2007 hurricane, not to be confused with a typhoon, when radio contact was invaluable during the electric shortout for nearly a week in some tempest-ravaged areas, including Astoria, and many more within range of this microphone. Not only were entire forests on the west side of the Coast Range blown down, but a large conifer with muscular branches crashed onto KMUN's roof, right across the top of the broadcast studio. KMUN was on the air with literally on-the-spot coverage. The long-range disaster we are sinking into like deep mud is the planet's change of climate that is occurring more rapidly than predicted. This is being made evident by the more drastic and extreme froth by murky climate deniers and the desperate grab to fully control American politics by corporate and financial magnates greatly responsible for erosion of humanity's future on its ransacked home planet, and they are especially bankrolling the 2016 presidential election. But aside from drought, responsible for a plethora of wildfires, forest-killing insect infestations, and water shortages, abrupt cataclysms are also palpable, not least of which is the growing certainty of a massive earthquake and tsunami combination due to rock and roll the Northwest Pacific coast any time between the next few seconds and half a century. And no matter when it happens, local coastal people should be concerned about projected ocean level rises. Oregon's shoreline has been swallowed in previous epochs of high water. Arctic melting will wash over the present levels of beach if a tsunami doesn't. Some examples of local vulnerability might flog a few memories and sensibilities and counter a collective disbelief, it can't happen here, and or indifference that singly or together generally react as public paralysis. These disasters have critically and painfully affected the Oregon coast and KMUN's broadcast area and are deeply lodged in the public memory, only needing a synaptic kick every so often, which, I hope, augments the purpose of this program, listener sponsor funding for local emergency radio broadcasting that will help we listeners through whatever disasters we encounter. So now, to begin our tour of family disasters, what more memorable a catastrophe than the volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens on May 18, 1980? At least 60 people died in the spectacular explosion of Mount St. Helens. Thousands of animals were killed, probably as many birds and trillions of insects. Entire forests were obliterated. Spirit Lake disappeared. Mudslides and log jams flooded the Toutle River and knocked out several bridges. The Columbia River Channel had to be dredged because mud washed downriver blocked ships. Eastern Washington was covered with volcanic ash as far as Spokane, and pumice littered ocean beaches. Millions of tons of dust were hurled into the sky, and it was thought a ring of dirt and smoke would form around Earth and reduce sunlight. Mount St. Helens was the prettiest mountain in the Pacific Northwest. Its shape was almost a perfect cone like Japan's Mount Fuji and was usually wrapped in snow. The first eruption was in late March 1980, and there have been numerous others in the 35 years since the cataclysmic May 18th blast, though none have approached its intensity or destruction. Oregon poet Walt Curtis wrote in an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle, June 1982, that male TV newscasters spoke of the St. Helens volcano as being an unruly female and told a corny joke, the reason why St. Helens erupted is that she didn't take her earth control pills. Curtis said his 65-year-old mother responded, "They're so stupid. The volcano is really named after a male," she said, an obscure British ambassador whose first name was Allen, which was, she said, spelled in an old-fashioned way. "I must admit I have always felt this gorgeous mountain possessed a feminine quality," Walt Curtis wrote. "The Klickitat Indians also thought of the volcano as a woman. She was Luwit, the Snow Witch. Uneasy magic has always been associated with St. Helens." Another misconstrued legend has grown about the mountain since its eruption. This one is about a man named Harry Truman, who became an authentic folk hero when he refused to leave the mountain that had been his home for half a century as proprietor of the popular Spirit Lake Lodge. The way popular history has of getting things confused, it will almost certainly be common knowledge that Harry Truman, who died in the May 18th eruption, was once president of the USA. The eruption of Mount St. Helens generated interest in disaster plans and emergency services on the Oregon coast. The area's vulnerability was highlighted by a volcanic ash fallout that blacked out two Columbia River cities and fell on all coastal areas. The most likely disaster that could strike the coast would be the predicted earthquake and tsunami, which is the Japanese word scientists adopted for seismic sea waves. They were presumably irritated at the use of the term tidal wave, because these waves had nothing to do with tides. Later, it was learned that tsunami is the Japanese word for tidal waves. Tsunamis are usually generated by earthquakes or volcanoes, and can also be triggered by nuclear explosions. The first tsunami of record wiped out Aminos on the Mediterranean island of Crete about 1400 BC. The last tsunami to strike the Oregon coast was a wave generated by the 1964 Alaska earthquake that centered primarily on Anchorage. Although most damage occurred when the wave's greatest force struck Crescent City, California, it wreaked havoc on its way south. Several coastal bridges in Washington and Oregon, and undoubtedly along the British Columbia coast, were washed away or damaged, and at least one Oregonian was killed. The most common causes of tsunamis are submarine earthquakes or quakes in coastal areas. The train of waves generated by such an event contains tremendous energy and moves away from the area at high speed. These waves are long and very low at sea. Their lengths may be as much as 150 miles and their height only a foot or two in deep water. They are almost imperceptible and pass under ships hardly noticed. It is when they approach land that these waves become a terrible danger to humanity. The influence of bottom topography and configuration of the coastline transform the low waves of deep water into waves as high as 100 feet. The wave that struck the Oregon coast in 1964 was estimated to have been 18 inches high at sea and 20 feet high when it hit the beach. The 1964 wave struck before coastal authorities had much chance to sound alarm. The Seaside Warning System, which consisted of 3 one-minute blasts on the city's fire department siren, had sounded only 30 seconds before the wave struck. It was the same all down the coast. Warning had been insufficient to evacuate everyone out of danger. The wave also left a psychological imprint. Several false tsunami warnings were sounded as a consequence, and people evacuated coastal towns in fear of their lives. An initial tsunami warning system was set up throughout the Pacific Basin after a landslide in the Aleutian Trench in 1946 sent seismic waves crashing on several Pacific shores, including a few that ravaged Hilo on the island of Hawaii. The warning system was set up by the U.S. Coast and Geodesic Survey and consisted of seismic stations scattered throughout the Pacific Rim, each equipped with automatic alarms and recording devices. This system, now computerized, enables the size, destination, and estimated time of arrival of a tsunami to be broadcast anywhere in the Pacific, often giving local populations several hours' notice in which to evacuate threatened areas. The warning system for the Oregon coast has greatly improved and become more sophisticated since 1964, but yet seems far short of adequate. At least coastal cities that did not have evacuation plans or emergency communication systems developed them, and as in Clatsop County, umbrella systems have been set up to coordinate disaster relief between communities and between public and private emergency agencies. Clatsop County consistently updating its emergency plans would have been an evacuation center if Longview or Kelso had been vacated during Mount St. Helens' volcanic ash fallout. The county is also designated as a host center for the Portland area in case of nuclear attack, though no one is sure how to keep the few roads into the county open during a mass evacuation. Of course, earthquakes and tsunamis are not the only disaster coastal cities must anticipate, and any emergency systems could break down in a crisis, which is why each family is advised to develop its own personal safety plan. And now, the Tillamook burn. 82 years ago, last month, the first great Tillamook burn started on August 14, 1933, and tore out the heart of Oregon's Coast Range. It was one of the wildest and most devastating fires ever recorded. More than 13 million board feet of timber that was worth $275 million in 1933 had been destroyed. Total acreage consumed by the fire was 411,000 acres, or more than 600 square miles of dead forest. The fire was actually several fires spawned by each other, and they burned over a distance from near Mount Hebo in the south to north of Seaside, and from Forest Grove almost to Wheeler. The fires burned out of control for 2 weeks, and one man was killed. In one period of 20 hours, the fire was so intense that it burned 240,000 acres. A famous photograph shows a monstrous black explosion of smoke hurling above a burning mountain. 6 years later, in August 1939, a fire almost the equal of its predecessor swept back over the burn. It took 4,000 firefighters more than a month to bring it under control. In 1945, a third fire killed another man and burned 8 weeks. A fire that lasted 4 days burned 20,000 acres in 1951. All four fires were 6 years apart, and all of them seemed to have been started by careless loggers. For years afterward, the timber companies mined the burned dead snags in the same manner that they would around Mount St. Helens after its May 18, 1980 eruption felled millions of trees. Reforestation in the Tillamook burn was delayed until the late 1940s when most of the snags were logged. Thousands of volunteers and school children worked for years to replant the forest. And of course, the timber companies want to clear cut those trees. Like the fires they started, there is not much in their path to stop them. The sweet smell of jobs is the scent they wear in hearings and negotiations. And now, no one should forget the Columbus Day storm of 1962. No one who lived through it will. A formerly famous Oregon writer and poet, Ellis Lucia, wrote a small book about the storm the following year, The Big Blow. This was his vivid synopsis before going into detail. Quote, on Columbus Day, October 12, 1962, nature went on a rampage as the most devastating windstorm ever to hit the Pacific Northwest rolled through Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. It created the greatest single natural disaster to strike the West Coast in more than half a century since the destructive 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. The Big Blow was a freak that roared out of nowhere, gave little warning, and spread widespread havoc to cities, towns, hamlets, farms, and forests along a 1,000-mile corridor, 125 miles wide, and covering an area of 75,000 square miles. In a few brief hours of terror, the Big Blow resulted in 50 deaths in 3 states, injured hundreds of others, smashed homes, staunched buildings, industrial plants, barns, warehouses, airports, and marinas, knocked out thousands of miles of telephone and power lines, and uprooted untold thousands of trees, which were sent careening onto cars and fine homes. The pulverizing wind wrecked beautiful parks, wiped out familiar landmarks, and brought modern living to a standstill, forcing people back onto their own resources to survive, not for a few hours, but for days and even weeks. It gave them a graphic lesson in civil defense preparedness and what life might be like if atomic missiles started falling, which the following month came perilously close to occurring, the Cuban Missile Crisis of November 1962. What the bark beetle and fire do to Northwest woods cannot be ascertained with any more accuracy than could the force of the big blow. The powerful blow left the paralyzed region a shambles, with losses mounting to $170 million to $200 million in Oregon alone, which received the storm's full wallop. The impact was a lasting one. The big wind left a permanent mark on private citizens, families, companies, industries, schools, churches, historical places, the men and women of the woods, government, the economy, on the land and on people themselves in innumerable ways. The phrases October storm, Columbus storm, and the day of the big wind will be around for a long, long while. And that was from The Big Blow by Ellis Lucia. And now, the great Astoria fire of December 8, 1922. This fire was comparable in its local effect to the fires that swept through Rome, 64 AD, London, 1666, Chicago, 1871, and San Francisco as a result of the 1906 earthquake. The fire burned for 22 hours, destroyed 32 blocks in Astoria's heart, and left 2,500 homeless. Three persons died, one possibly an unrelated suicide, and ultimate damages were estimated at nearly $30 million. The fire's origins were never determined. Aid poured in from all over. Portland contributed $53,000, and Victor Astor in New York, founder JJ's heir, sent $5,000. The fire started a few minutes after 2 a.m. on December 8th. It raged all day. The city's firemen of those days must have long dreaded such a fire. The downtown plumbing system was little more than a medieval maze of wooden troughs interlaced among the wood pilings most of the city was built upon. Instead of firemen being able to depend upon a reliable water supply for their hoses, these wooden water mains became part of the conflagration, and fire hoses burst on the hot streets. Can anyone truly imagine how hard those firemen must have worked to stop the fire? Every time they lost a street, they fought for the next one, breathing smoke, no respirators or face masks, burning up in sweat from the inferno, yet chilled by a cold night wind that fanned the fire. Block after block consumed by flames, forcing firefighters to retreat as the fire irresistibly advanced. Firemen fought to save City Hall and St. Mary's Hospital. Patients were removed to Astoria High School. Walter Matula wrote in the Astorian Budget newspaper commemorating the fire's 25th anniversary in 1947. Where there was no water, dynamite was substituted, Matula wrote. Hotels, dwellings and street intersections went up and the fire went on. Matula wrote that by 1922, Astoria was an out-of-date city of deteriorating wooden buildings. Its waterfront had been built up for making money in handling grain, Shanghai, and fleecing its large male population of mariners, fishermen, and loggers. This waterfront was dying. The town still retained the name of a wide-open hangout, but the money in crime was gone. So was the big shipping of the 1870s and 80s. The cannery empire was past its prime. The Chinese and Hindus employed in the canneries and mills were gone and left behind their combustible shacks. Matula wrote, the fire kept on coming, north, south, east, and west, often breaking out far ahead of the cauldron at the heart of the city. Power failed, gas mains burst and blazed, cars, trucks, wheelbarrows, and stooped backs and held out arms carried away goods from stores. Stacks of office furniture, phonographs, records boxes, and bundles of articles, fur coats, dishes, lodge paraphernalia, all the goods of the city were heaped back of the fire. They had to be moved again as the fire advanced. Looters snatched goods, broke into stores, and carried off stocks in the guise of helping out. It was bright as day in Astoria, except in basements, inner rooms, and where smoke rolled thick. By 6 a.m., all of Astoria that once stood on stilts over the river was burning, Matula wrote. From then on, the fire was gradually put under control, with some losses. Late in the day, snow fell over the black ruins of old Astoria, but melted in the embers that glowed for weeks while the new Astoria was born. Headlines in Oregon newspapers that day told the story. Astoria's heart in ruins. City destroyed by flames. Fire raises 35 blocks. Astoria business district destroyed. Telephone girls stuck until flames reach building. Stores and offices in fiery pile. Astoria swept by greatest conflagration in Northwest history. At the end of the day, Astoria's heart was a smoldering ruin or had dropped into the river and sizzled. Three persons were dead, a couple of thousand homeless. City Hall on the east end of the city survived, but the fire killed it as the center of municipal administration. A decade later, the city abandoned it for a downtown bank built after the fire, and the building has since been the site of the original Columbia River Maritime Museum and currently HQ of the Clatsop County Historical Society. Before the fire, the deteriorating downtown was slowly abandoned by business and politics eastward to a newer section of the city. The fire altered that migration, and Astoria was resurrected on its ruins, similar to the regrowth of forests after fire. Compared to its hillside dwellings, downtown Astoria is relatively young, most of it having been reconstructed from the ruins of the Great Astoria Fire. Matula wrote in his 25th anniversary article that Astorians, all of them, as if their spirits had been tempered in the fire, took on the task of rebuilding their city. In the blackest hour of destruction, there was no wailing voice of defeat. And now, 9/11. USA. The nightmare angst that has overlapped American life and politics in the 14 years since 9/11 has also been a highly charged personal nightmare, that a hijacked jet airplane loaded with helpless captives is aimed at all our windows. It is a nightmare that has proved very fruitful for the homeland fearmongers who have kept the terrorist paranoia at high fever since September 11, 2001, the day the calendar stopped, whenever the interminable wars the U.S. has weaved itself into since are questioned or criticized. Macabre images recall 9/11. Falling bodies of people who jumped to their deaths from the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center to escape the fires started by the passenger-filled jet airliners that were suicided into the buildings. Thousands of hands reaching up as if to stop the collapsing South Tower of the WTC. Doomed firemen going up into the towers, passing, fleeing survivors going down. A few images from 9/11 that are seldom recalled or even noticed are yet bleakly revealing. A woman on 9/11 morning in New York City described a surreal atmosphere of people standing on street corners staring up at the flaming towers, and after they collapsed, seemed to numbly stare at the subsequent pile of rubble that was vast and several stories high. Another woman said she saw crowds of people walking away from Ground Zero, stunned after the towers collapsed. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Away," they said. Homeland Security was cobbled into a cabinet position, and its first real task, providing relief after Hurricane Katrina and the New Orleans flood 4 years later, was a dismal fiasco and failure. The 10 years since have not redeemed FEMA. The Gulf oil spill showed its true loyalties. There are a few certainties among the disingenuousness, principally that since 9/11, the war on terror is perpetual and no closer to closure than the day it ostensibly started with that astonishing surprise attack on the USA that has congealed the calendar. And especially now, the forthcoming Cascadia earthquake and tsunami. The Juan de Fuca tectonic plate is burrowing under the North American plate. A huge earthquake is forecast, and not so long ago, scientists discovered that Northwest Terra is bulging, a sure sign of a quake building up like a big burp. Indian legends of earthquakes, until recently discounted as fairy tales, correspond with geographical data. Ghost forests of 300-year dead trees found along northwest coasts were killed by tsunamis generated by earthquakes. Earlier eruptions and a few volcanoes raised up the Cascades. Most of Astoria might very well be demolished in an earthquake. The hills will collapse into the river. The downtown landfill, which replaced the wood pilings that burned in the Great Astoria Fire of 1922, will dissolve like Alka-Seltzer. People going uphill to avoid tsunamis in the river will meet the hill crumbling down. Schools and churches designated as evacuation and relief centers will probably be wiped out. No streets left for fire trucks and rescue vehicles. Maybe no water except for the unpalatable ocean-flooded river. Worst-case scenario projection is a new range of volcanoes where Astoria still clings to existence as I speak. Existing on top of the Cascadia earthquake subduction zone might compare to the uncertainty of virtually everything humanity is encountering, from pandemic pestilences such as Ebola, AIDS, or influenza, to consequences of its own doing, such as possible nuclear war or atmospheric pesticide contamination. Uneasily, perhaps subliminally, seaside Northwesterners await the colossal earthquake and its accompanying gigantic tsunami that is augured to wash the Pacific Northwest coast clean of us. If indeed an LNG terminal is absurdly built on unstable earthquake subduction sand against the wishes of nearly everybody, why not consolidate the insanity and use it also as a coal and unrefined oil export terminal, as well as for nuclear wastes shipped from Hanford? Name it Disaster City. No place on Earth is safe, of course, and most of us are more likely to be traffic fatalities or victims of random gun murders than tsunami or hot lava swimmers. Free falling through cracks in the ground, buried underneath rubble, or drowned by huge waves are seldom perceived as probable endings. The thought of Jack and Jilling down a crumbling hill into a seismic lashed river is not sweet. And we all remember the hurricane of 2007. And I'd like to finish this program, this pledge drive for money, so that we can be made aware of emergencies via our radio station, KMUN. I'd like to read a poem by Carolyn Dunn, Liquefied Natural Gas. Any tanker that will carry LNG will be tossed hard by the notorious conflicting waters at a river's mouth, or, surviving those, could become the target for some zealot just now born, who years from now will climb aboard this floating hearse, turn a valve handle, light a match, one of several stuck in his boot just to make sure, and start the conflagration that will make the diners at the river's edge and the tourists buying small town trinkets and the lawyer attending a port commission meeting and the dentist deadening an open mouth, and the parking meter employee chalking a tire, and the woman walking into City Hall to pay her water bill, and the dog barking at a scrabble of crows in its yard, and the plumber cleaning the U-pipe under a sink, and the student nurse performing her first catheterization, and the kid walking his skateboard to the other side of the hill, and the grandparent counting out cash for a grandchild's birthday present, and the man using his cell phone while walking down the sidewalk, and a shopkeeper putting a back soon sign on the door of the shop, and the 15 girls and boys clapping their hands in the nursery school, all stop all at once in unison, so to speak, under the superheated blast that was sparked by the match and now travels the path of the wind off our ocean, so that moments afterward, the obsidian black of the town melt will be what our roads lead to, and all those mentioned and not mentioned, a swift ash within a blinding monument of flame. And that was Liquefied Natural Gas by Carolyn Dunn, who died of ALS a couple of years back, and I miss her very much. She once was Clatsop Community College's librarian. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Pledge Drive.